Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
So my roof leaks like a sieve, and to replace it would cost me another $500 of polycarbonate, so I'm not going to do that. So I just deal with it.
After 3 years of growing food, Adam Phelps is still getting the hang of this whole farming thing. We visit his Ghostwood farm to talk about the day-to-day struggles of being a farmer. We found two recipes using asparagus to feature today. Chef Daniel Orr makes a salad and then fires up the grill. Harvest Public Media gives us some historical perspective on how the local food world has grown. And from Sri Lanka to southern Indiana, Guy Paranavitana took his passion for tea halfway around the world. We stop by his warehouse in the second half. Three stories from across the food landscape with Luann Johnson.
Fast food worker protests took place this week, one of several over the past 18 months. This time, protests spread worldwide. Organizers were hoping for demonstrations in 80 cities and 30 countries, in addition to protests in 150 American cities. They are pushing for a $15 an hour wage. Restaurant companies say that's unrealistic. The costs of meat and milk have reached record levels, and food companies are hoping to share the financial burden with consumers. Kraft will soon increase prices on about 45% of its products. Retail pork prices hit a record high of $1.99 a pound, so Hillshire increased the price of ballpark hot dogs. And did you notice McDonald's eliminated its dollar menu last year? That was to give the fast food giant flexibility to raise prices. Chipotle is upping its prices this quarter, but with a trade-off for consumers. The burrito chain removed almost all food ingredients made with GMOs. But heads up, food companies. According to Deloitte's annual survey of food shoppers released last week, 94% said they would keep spending at the same level, even if the economy improves. And researchers say new evidence bolsters a theory that milk from the majority of cows in the U.S. contains a possible intestinal irritant. Most of the milk cows in the U.S. and Europe produce milk with a mutated protein known as A1 beta casein. Milk from Asian and African bovine breeds only contains an older form of the protein, A2 beta casein. The new study, published in the International Journal of Food Sciences and Nutrition, found that rats that drank A1 milk digested their food more slowly than rats that drank the A2 milk and suffered from some bowel inflammation. The research lines up with anecdotes from African and Asian immigrants who claim they can drink milk at home, but U.S. milk makes them sick. There's been a lot of debate about the benefits of A2 milk over the years, and plenty of critics remain unconvinced. A release blasting the claims cited an earlier study that concluded, quote, insufficient overall evidence that either milk has benefits over the other, unquote. Links to read more about these stories are collected on our website. Find this week's podcast post at eartheats.org.
And as always, hop on our Twitter feed for food news all day, every day, twitter.com/eartheats. Luann Johnson, thanks for the news.
My pleasure.
The drive for local food has been gaining popularity all over the country. While some farmers try to meet demand directly through farmers markets and farm stands, advocates have spent years building a local food system. We're beginning a three-part series today called the Local Food Challenge. In the first story, Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports that local food advocates are starting to see the fruits of their labor.
There and there, we're going to start planting some stuff for the spring garden. So carrots, tomatoes.
Ashley Turk is navigating her way through a brand new greenhouse in the courtyard at Waukon High School in the northeast corner of Iowa.
Really done well. You can see our lettuce is huge and we just cut it off and it keeps going.
Students here serve themselves these veggies at the cafeteria salad bar. Turk is a member of the Federal Food Corps program.
Being with Food Corps, it's kind of like a domestic Peace Corps, but it's unique in that there's public-private partnerships. So it's 20% funded by AmeriCorps and then 80% funded by private donors.
Her job is to support the school district's commitment to local foods. That such a job, or Food Corps itself, even exists speaks to the tenacity of local food advocates. Initially, they thought closer-to-home food supplies would prevent shortages in times of disaster and would bring healthy, fresh food to more people. That's according to historian Maureen Ogle.
Particularly through farmer to consumer marketplaces, the things we now called farmers market. And in the 1970s, they began agitating, not lobbying the USDA to get financial and official support.
She says savvy political activists used private funding to get their ideas off the ground. And once they had programs underway, the public started to catch on and Congress took notice. Available figures are somewhat hazy, but in the 1990s, local food sales nationwide were likely under $500 million. In 2008, that figure approached $5 billion.
The first 7 or 8 years of success in getting into the Farm Bill consisted of at least getting official recognition.
Today, USDA's Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food campaign oversees the department's myriad programs that support local food efforts. And this year, President Obama signed what could be called the most local food-friendly farm bill yet. It triples the funding from the previous farmers market program and expands it to include other local food promotion efforts.
We've received funding from USDA Rural Development, especially around our food aggregation piece, offering technical assistance to farmers.
That's Iowa State University Extension Agent Teresa Wimmerslag, who works closely with farmers and buyers. Like many other business owners, farmers need to market their products. They need research on the latest technology, and they have to build connections in the community to nurture a local market. One key, Wimmerslag says, is to combine public support for local food with private money. Her group has a grant from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation.
So I think that's what's really great about the model that we have in Northeast Iowa is that we have enough partners around the table where we can strategically think about what's going to move the work ahead the best.
Because, of course, the goal is sustainable business practices for the farms, independent of grant funding. So innovation remains a constant. When USDA handed down new rules for school lunches requiring fruits and vegetables every day, Wimmerslag saw an opportunity.
How can we make sure that we have a value chain that starts with the production here and ends up feeding our kids at the schools where they spend all their time?
Working together, farmers and food service directors came up with menu items built around local offerings. In Decorah, about 20 miles from Waukon, fresh salsa from local tomatoes became a regular on fall menus. So did produce from school gardens. The greenhouse at Decorah High School is attached to one of the classrooms. In early spring, it's primarily herbs, such as parsley, growing inside. Senior Brianna Burke is one of the students who's grown food for school meals.
The school is trying to cut down on using salt to make the food healthier, and so then by putting more herbs in it, it definitely makes it taste better.
Growing some produce on site keeps prices low for schools, but increasingly the schools in this area are finding buying from local farms is affordable, and the growers are happy to meet the demand. Because as the concept of local food systems matures, the customer base no longer has to be an individual person or family. Whole communities and the many places where people shop and eat are getting on board. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Next week, part two of their local food challenge. You hear it all the time. Farming is not easy. The weather works against you, pests can decimate your crops, and then there's human error, of course. Most of the time on Earth Eats, we talk to farmers who have it at least sort of figured out. But how about a dose of real life today?
So what are the characteristics of a beginning farmer?
You mess everything up the first 7 times. You spend more than you need to. You do things over and over again, and you keep doing them wrong.
Adam Phelps of Ghostwood Farm. He's been growing food in Lawrence County, Indiana for about 3 years. His property is 33 acres, but right now he's only farming about 1 acre of that. Another acre is ruled by his 100 chickens who produce about 55 eggs daily.
Another thing I failed at is keeping the chickens out of the barn, as you can see. They're so dumb. They just, any little thing will set them off.
To be fair, he admits that he's managed pretty well to keep all his birds alive, despite some trouble with foxes last year. We walk into the greenhouse, which is home to his tomato and pepper starter plants. He had to invest plenty of time and money into turning this structure into a place fit for plants.
When we got this place, this was all just a lean-to that was enclosed. We took the roof off and the whole side off and put up the steel and the windows and the fiberglass and then the polycarbonate on the ceiling. And this has been a big time investment that I keep messing up. I've tried a bunch of different things, and I think I'm getting kind of close to getting it right.
Well, what are you messing up?
Well, for one thing, the polycarbonate is corrugated, right? So it's got up and down. And when I put it up, I nailed it in the gullies because that way it's held tight to the wood. The problem is that's where the rain runs. So my roof leaks like a sieve. And to replace it would cost me another $500 of polycarbonate. So I'm not going to do that. So I just deal with it.
Adaptability, a good character trait for a farmer, I'd say. In the second half of our show, some successes on Ghostwood Farm with Adam Phelps. When I spoke with Phelps earlier this month, he wasn't sure when his asparagus would be ready. A little info about this early spring treat. Asparagus is a perennial plant, so be sure to choose the spot in your garden carefully because they'll grow there for some 20 years.
It's amazing how they grow because one day they'll be nothing and the next day there'll be all these little asparagus spears coming up.
Chef Daniel Orr is able to wander around his garden and pick two asparagus spears here, another three or four over there. It's like a salad bar in his yard. Now in the kitchen for the good part.
I've just simply thrown these on the grill. Now, a lot of people, they want to marinate them beforehand, and all that does is that oil and marinade drips off and, you know, you have fire streaming up over your asparagus and it's burning and, you know, so I always grill my vegetables plain or dry and then marinate them afterward. And we're going to cook them until they just start to blister and have a little caramelization around the edges. All right, so you hear it kind of snapping and crackling, and that's really all there is to it. I'm just going to pull that off. And make a little salad out of it. I've got a portobello cap here that I've grilled. I'm just going to stack these guys up on top of that portobello. And then, you know, use your favorite vinaigrettes, put that around, kind of frame it. I'm going to marinate the asparagus with a little lemon vinaigrette, which is just simply one part lemon juice to two parts olive oil, and then seasoned with salt and pepper. So simple as that. And then I've got some basil oil. Okay, and I'm just going to serve that with a little wedge of grapefruit that we can squeeze on top of it, and that's going to really make all the flavors pop.
Asparagus and mushrooms make for good plate mates. Asparagus also plays well with tomato plants in your garden. Tomato plants repel the asparagus beetle. This recipe, more gardening tips at eartheats.org. Chef Daniel Orr promises another asparagus recipe in about 10 minutes. He also takes requests. We're visiting Chef D in the kitchen later this month to collect a new batch of local seasonal recipes. What ingredients do you want him to cook with? Any particular dishes? Write us your requests to eartheats@gmail.com or tweet us at eartheats. Coming up, for all you tea drinkers out there, we have a story about a real tea aficionado.
From the time I was young, from the time I was about 9 or 10 years old, I wanted to be a tea planter.
From Sri Lanka to Columbus, Indiana, tea warehouse owner Guy Paranavitana tells us his story. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-202-0055. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Welcome back. 1 million pounds of tea leaves can make about 70 million cups of tea. That's how much tea a Columbus, Indiana business owner used to process yearly in his Sri Lankan facility. He now owns a tea warehouse in South Central Indiana. What happened in between is quite a story. WFIU's James Gray introduces us to Guy Paranavitana.
I used to believe the process of making tea started with heating water or steeping leaves, but that's changed since I talked to Guy.
My name is Lalit Guy Paranavitana.
Guy is originally from Sri Lanka, a small island country just off the southern coast of India. Now Guy runs Empire Tea Services in Columbus, Indiana. And when I drove to it, I wondered, as you probably are, why would there be a tea warehouse in Columbus, Indiana? There were fields, but as I mentioned to Guy, none of them look like tea fields to me. Guy imports his tea from China, from India, and some from his home Sri Lanka. That's where Guy lived and worked until 1989. It's a beautiful country. Guy leads tours of Sri Lanka, and he showed me some photos. They were filled with lush green fields.
That's the factory that I managed last of all.
He showed me a photo. It's framed on the wall. Guy and his wife are sitting down in the photo. There are about 30 men surrounding them, and what I notice is that nobody is smiling, but it is clearly a special occasion.
From the time I was young, from the time I was about 9 or 10 years old, I wanted to be a tea planter.
That's someone who manages tea estates and factories. When Guy was young, his cousin was a tea planter.
And my dad used to take us to his place for vacations, like a huge house with visitors' rooms and all that, and a cook and a gardeners and a chauffeur.
The lifestyle left an impression on Guy.
What I did not see him do was the hard work, because he used to come home and entertain us. And I thought it was just a fun thing to do. I loved that life. I did that for 20 years until the circumstances in Sri Lanka was such that I had to leave.
In the late 80s, communist revolutionary groups were resorting to violent means to shut down private enterprise in the country. Their actions went far beyond strikes and protests. And you left because you were feeling sort of unsafe professionally or physically?
Yes, physically unsafe because of the attempted revolution, because they were killing people. Anybody who was opposed to the revolutionary ideas was a target.
Then one night, some revolutionaries came looking for Guy.
Yeah, they were looking for me to maybe do something to me, I don't know.
They came to your bungalow?
Yeah.
Were you there?
No, I wasn't there, fortunately. So, and in 2 days later, I was gone, so I escaped that. It was a narrow escape, though.
Guy had been a guest of the Rotary Club in Columbus, and he had made friends there. So when his friends from Columbus found out he was in danger, they told him to come to the U.S. quickly. They told him to leave Sri Lanka. That's why his tea warehouse is in South Central Indiana. He recognized that this was his chance to leave a dangerous situation, and he opened up shop here. Guy prepares 6 cups of tea for me. He does it meticulously. The white tea is prepared at 170 degrees. The green tea is prepared at 185 degrees. For black tea, the water is almost boiling. Guy has a large variety of tea blends.
So we are almost ready to taste the white tea. These are made only with buds. That's why it's called a white tea, because the buds are white in color, as you saw.
We stood beside the tea. The sun left colorful shadows on the table, different shades of greens and yellows as the light came through the glass. Guy had placed little balls of jasmine leaves called jasmine pearls into hot water, and we watched them as they unfolded into long tendrils.
This is a green tea, a high elevation green tea from China.
You slurp it like that?
You can slurp it, or just simply swirl it in your mouth.
It tastes so good. It tastes, I don't know, the word gentle maybe? How it's fresh.
Thanks to James Gray for that story. Guy Paranavitana runs Empire Tea Services in Columbus. See some great photos of the tea tasting at eartheats.org.
What do we grow? You know, some of the stuff we grow.
Do you need a prompt?
Do you want me to prompt? Okay, here.
What is?
Yeah, and what else?
That was a whisper.
Asparagus.
Look at this.
Asparagus, that's right.
That's his 4-year-old helper and daughter back on Ghostwood Farms with Adam Phelps, who has been farming almost as long as she's been alive. His 33-acre property is mostly woods, so the battle with deer is never ending.
The first year we were here, we had a little garden up there, and they eat everything down to the ground.
When Phelps dug up the 1-acre lot for growing more food, he erected an electric fence to deter the deer.
It works out pretty well. I bait it with peanut butter, and they come along with their little noses and touch that electric fence, and they learn to fear it. So the only time I've really had problems since I've had the fence up was the drought year 2 years ago. And they would fight right through that electric fence to get in here.
The drought is but a distant memory at this point. Phelps is still recovering from this past winter.
Yeah, you know, I'm behind on everything because the ground thawed late and it was so wet. And I mean, it seems like every time I start to think about getting the tiller out, we get an inch of rain. And that puts it away for a week at least. You know, the asparagus hasn't almost at all come up yet, which is unusual. The radishes are starting off really slowly. The spinach is starting off really slowly. I expect things to really pick up now that it's going to get nice. But if it gets hot, the spinach and lettuce can go right from edible to seed and right past the really edible stage quickly. So I hope we have a nice spring. I hope it stays kind of cool now that it's starting to warm up.
One of the perks of the epic cold temperatures several months ago, he's hoping it killed some of the pests. Phelps struggles most with spotted cucumber beetles and squash bugs. Fingers crossed he hasn't had to deal with asparagus beetles on his farm. He proudly owned the title of beginning farmer in the first half of our show. He's not sure he'll earn his black belt in growing food anytime soon because every new season presents new challenges.
I don't know. You know, we learn something new every year. Some of the things that I learned last year, you know, trellising tomatoes. I've been growing tomatoes for 10 years, but trellising them makes a huge difference, you know, and you can find this stuff on the internet, but you don't believe it until you do it yourself. Okra. Stink bugs love okra. So this year I'm going to plant okra at the end of every bed to try to trap some stink bugs and keep them off my crops. We'll see if it works. Oh, you know, they're, in my opinion, the only thing that should be eating okra is stink bugs. No, buy my okra. It's great.
Aw, no love for okra. Adam Phelps of Ghostwood Farm is setting up a table today at the first day of the Smithville Farmers Market this season. He'll definitely have eggs to sell. Chances are he'll have asparagus. See photos at eartheats.org.
Let's get the water boiling.
Asparagus on the brain today. Daniel Orr back again, setting things up for another asparagus recipe. His cooking is enhanced by his green thumb. His garden in Columbus, Indiana is quite an impressive spread. He plucks some asparagus, a few potatoes, and greens fresh from the ground. Let's see what he comes up with.
Well, this just kind of shows that, you know, being a chef is more about ingredients than anything else. And we're going to just use those few ingredients that we pulled up today. We've got about 6 or 8 beautiful little new potatoes. Really beautiful. We're just going to cut these into some little pieces. And people think that cooking a meal has to take a long time. You're going to see that this meal that we're having is going to take really just probably under 5 minutes to prepare. Got some of those nice lettuces out of the garden. In this case, we're using some of the mezclan that we had, which has some red oak leaf, some green oak leaf, a little bit of Lola Rosa. Then we've got these fun, great big, little bit overgrown asparagus. And we're going to snap those just into pieces. And you kind of, when they stop snapping easy, that means they're too tough to eat. And then we've got this nice Wabash cannonball, which is goat cheese from Judy Shad down at Capriole Farms. We're using a little bit of olive oil in a nonstick pan. And we're going to cook some of these great eggs from Gretchen's. What I'm going to do is just cover them with a plate. And what that's going to do is allow them to cook very gently and kind of be sheared eggs. At the same time, I've got my potatoes cooking over here, some salted water. I'm going to just leave those really, really simple.
In with the asparagus?
In with the asparagus, right in that same water with the potatoes. Turn off our eggs. And I'm leaving both the potatoes and the asparagus a little bit crunchy. When they're this fresh, I think that that's the best way to enjoy them. Put those right on top of the lettuce, kind of wilting it. I cut up some of Judy's cheese to put around. Okay, and we're just going to drizzle a little good extra virgin olive oil and a little bit of your favorite vinegar. Okay, and that and some nice crusty bread.
That's gorgeous. Let's eat.
Yeah, let's go bring it outside. Okay, I'll get some forks. Now, when you're eating this, I've left these kind of sunny-side-up eggs, so you break the yolk, and that's kind of your dipping sauce to dip your asparagus and your potatoes in. The other thing is, a lot of people are so worried about having undercooked eggs, but if you know where they come from, you know that they've been produced properly and they've been handled properly, you really don't need to worry about it. Here you go, Dad.
Okay.
So this has a little bit of the local Indiana goat cheese, some of our homegrown potatoes, asparagus, homegrown lettuce, and then Gretchen's egg with a little bit of olive oil and Cabernet Sauvignon vinegar.
Those eggs, oh, they came from Daniel Orr's friend Gretchen Marks, who is a small-scale chicken farmer and an artist. She creates these amazing collages out of the chicken feed bags, which you can see on our website. With recipes and interviews and news stories, it's all at eartheats.org. A shout-out to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible. Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, James Gray, Lou Ann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Guy Paranavitana, Adam Phelps, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for being part of our local seasonal world. For Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan.